change the world with my own two hands. Make it a better place with my own two hands. Make it a kinder place with my own two hands. With my own, with my own two hands. I can make peace on earth with my own two hands. I can clean up the earth with my own two hands. I can reach out to you with my own two hands. With my own, with my own two hands. With my own, with my own two hands. I'm gonna make it a brighter place with my own two hands. I'm gonna make it a safer place with my own two hands. I'm gonna help the human race with my own two hands. With my own, with my own two hands. With my own, with my own two hands. I can hold you in my own two hands. And I can comfort you with my own two hands. But you got to use your own two hands. Use your own, use your own two hands. Use your own, use your own two hands. With our own, with our own two hands. With our own.
Thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Bonnie Faulkner interview David K. Johnston, and they talk about how big companies use plain English to rob you blind.
Exactly. I love the title of one of the sections in your book, The Fine Print, called A Festival of Fees. Well, David, I'd like to give the chance to the listeners to call in and ask you a few questions. 510-848-4425. 510-848-4425. If you have a question for investigative journalist and author David K. Johnston about his new book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob Your Blind, economic questions, regulatory questions, banks, you name it. So while we're waiting to get a few people on the line, you write about what you refer to as corporate socialism. Profits are privatized and losses are socialized. What's an example? Well, I guess we've talked about a lot of them.
We've talked about a lot of them, but the best one of all is what went on Wall Street. You know, Alan Greenspan, who a lot of people don't know this, he is so far right. He was the executor of the estate of Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Alan Greenspan, you know, testified to Congress. Nobody saw what was coming. Well, excuse me, I have bylines in the New York Times in 2004. Where I made a record to make sure that people could see that I could say later, I saw this coming. There's a housing bubble. Anybody who paid attention to the data knew by 2002 that there was a housing bubble.
Right.
And on top of that, we have these wacky rules where banks, we separated responsibility from risk and reward from responsibility when they took these bad mortgages, many of which were total frauds committed by the banks themselves. A Countrywide had a room they called Arts and Crafts, where they fabricated documents to make loans. And they sold them to Wall Street, which then cut them up into pieces and resold them in ways that you could never turn them back to the banks. And then who did they sell these investments to? Well, a lot of them were sold to public employee pension funds. So you were getting, you were going to take the loss as a taxpayer when these things collapsed. Well, we bailed out Wall Street. Hank Paulson, the former head of Goldman Sachs, a company that earns over 1% of all the profits in America, Hank Paulson told Congress, you have to give me all this money and no accountability. Well, they demanded at least a little bit of accountability. U.S. taxpayers put at risk, according to Bloomberg Business News, $14.7 trillion to bail out Wall Street. That is the entire output of the entire economy. Everything everybody in America did for the entire year of 2008. Now, it didn't cost that much, but that's how much was at risk.
Yes.
My goodness. I mean, that's equal to 2,200 years of the women, infants, and nutrition program that the far-right Republicans want to get rid of.
Well, yes, and the trillions are continuing to flow to Wall Street and to the banks, right? And so much of it is secret. It's not even, we don't even know what it is.
Right. Well, one of the things I reveal in the book is a $5 billion gift the taxpayers made to Goldman Sachs, and I'm the only person who's written about it in the public record, but I can't find any evidence anybody else wrote about it. And Goldman Sachs, by the way, built a new corporate headquarters in New York. Its name is not on the building anywhere. It was built in large part with your tax dollars, and they moved a bunch of their operations over to New Jersey, where they're one of the companies that gets to pocket the state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks. And since many of those workers were already living in New Jersey and commuting into New York, part of Goldman Sachs' theory, and I think it's a good theory, is why are we having workers spending all this time commuting? We'll move the back office over to where they live in New Jersey. It means that the state of New Jersey used to collect income tax from these workers when they worked in New York City, but now that they work in New Jersey, the state doesn't get the income tax. Goldman Sachs does.
Too much. David, we have Karen in Oakland on the line. Karen, do you have a question for David K. Johnston?
Yes, I do. How do you know that Warren, or how will we know that Warren Buffett owns all of these banks? I thought he was one of the good rich guys, but my goodness, this is appalling. And can we do to protect ourselves or to do something about it?
Well, the problem isn't that he owns the banks. And the reason we know that he owns the banks is that's what I do for a living. There are public records of these things. If you want to, you can go to the SEC website, Securities and Exchange Commission website, SEC.gov. There's a button there called EDGAR, Electronic Disclosure and Document Retrieval or something, EDGAR, E-D-G-A-R. And you put in Berkshire-Hathaway, the name of the company, and it'll spit up unbelievable amounts of documents. And if you want to search through and read these things, you can discover amazing things about these companies that are in the public record. The annual report called a 10K for some companies now is 11, 12, 1300 pages. So it's also easy to bury things in those documents. But all these things are disclosed. I don't think there's a problem per se with Mr. Buffett being so rich, but he uses those riches and have his lobbyists go and get rules that are antithetical to the public interest. And yet, if you watch the profile of him on CNBC with Sue Herrera, he's just the nicest grandfatherly fellow, you know, who he just drives a Lincoln Continental. I mean, your doctor might drive a Lincoln Continental, and he goes to lunch at either McDonald's or his own chain that he owns, Johnny Rockets, and he lives in the same house he bought in 1954, and he's just an ordinary guy.
Right. This
nonsense.
The sage of Omaha.
Yeah, absolute nonsense. I mean, he didn't make all his money except by being cold-blooded in his economic decisions, and he basically is risk-averse. That is, he invests in companies where he knows he can make huge profits, mostly because the government rules favor him. By the way, there's a chapter in my book about how a nurse working for a company hired by Mr. Buffett, one of Mr. Buffett's companies, asked a man in Sacramento to die because he was costing him too much money to keep him alive. It's a really horrifying story.
Yes, you've got a whole chapter on that. That is horrifying. We have Habu in Madison, Wisconsin on the phone. Do you have a question for David K. Johnston?
May I add a brief comment, too?
Yes.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, and it's very riveting to listen to this. Not that this is news to me. The comment is that, you know, this profligacy in the United States has no limits. And one was when we went into Iraq. We told the Iraqis that they needed a seed law. They didn't know think they needed one, but so that was how we could inject Monsanto into the whole picture. But that's another thing. And then yesterday, little Grinnell College in Iowa, a very good liberal arts school, goes and scores 180 points in basketball at that small level, low level league that they play in. This shows the kind of just no regard for decency and respect for other people. But here's my question to you, sir, and that is that I believe there's a big kind of conspiracy of sorts to keep the price of oil high, and that was by, you know, President Clinton opening up the commodity is excess so that people who weren't taking delivery or had product to deliver or take can now buy contracts, including your pension fund or mutual fund, etc. And this was done so that they could then artificially bid up the price, but this was for a reason, so that marginal oil sources, as the one coming from on the Keystone pipeline, which is a big stir in this country, you know, the amount of energy it takes to go and dig up that those oil sands and get the water in it and heat the water up. So this requires a floor on the oil price so that it is viable, and they're putting, you know, almost $1 billion into those projects, so they wanted to be guaranteed that this would be sustainable. Do you see my logic, and is this something that you investigated?
Yeah. Abu, this is not a thing I've written a lot about, but you've hit upon a couple of things. One of the things is oil is a global commodity, and it's the most valuable commodity you have. So why we are spending enormous amounts of tax dollars to subsidize the oil company is a great mystery. Presumably, you subsidize things that the market isn't producing, not things that are making a lot of money, and it's a good example of how business gets government to give it favors that are undeserved. In the case of the oil price trading, yes, the Clinton administration did some of the worst things that happened, and one of them is it used to be that if you traded in commodities, pork bellies, grain, oil, orange juice futures, it was done by people in the business. So if you're making cereal, it makes sense that even before the next crop is planted, you go guarantee a price for certain cereal because you need to have it. You have a factory. You want to keep people employed. People want to go to the grocery store and get the box with your cereal in it. But suddenly they changed the rules, and pure speculators could get in there. Well, we know that when the price of oil went to $140 a barrel, that was done by bidding up the price, artificially inflating it. And if you want to explore these sources like the shale oil, I mean, there's enough carbon locked in rocks in the Colorado Rockies and the Canadian North to fuel automobiles and airplanes for centuries, but it's tremendously costly and requires tremendous amounts of energy to get it out of the ground. You can only justify that if the price of oil is very high. This is also the problem faced, by the way, by the solar and wind energy businesses, because there's another force at work here. That's why I think it's a little more complicated than presented. If the price goes up, those become viable alternatives. But if you push the price of oil down somewhat, solar and wind don't attract the same investment. And they are also subsidized, particularly wind. So this is a very complicated situation, but without a question, the Clinton administration rules promoted by Phil Graham that allow commodity trading by pure speculators have tended to drive up prices, and they've certainly not been a boon to the economy. They have been a boon to the speculators.
Yes, that's a very, very important point. We're running out of time, but I want to sneak in one last call from Joey in West Marin. Joey, do you have a question for David K. Johnston?
Yes, it's Kenny, actually. And the question is how much money was it that Jamie Dimon actually went into gambling with? And the other question is what about these like nonprofit credit unions as an alternative to Chase?
Okay, got it. I'd recommend go to read the column I wrote about Jamie Dimon and the trade. It's called Hedginess, just like Stephen Colbert's Truthiness. So if you go to Google, you put in Hedginess Dimon, D-I-M-O-N, there's no D at the end, D-I-M-O-N, and Reuters, R-U-T-E-R-S. It should pop up. My Reuters page is still there. I'm not a columnist anymore for Reuters. I quit them 2 months ago. But
okay. It'll
tell you a lot about that deal and why Dimon had to be lying through his teeth from the very beginning about what was going on there. This was not a hedge. This was a speculative bet. On the other issue, the community banks and the credit unions have not been the problem. Yeah, you can point to this or that individual community bank or credit union that has failed, but it's not like the too big to fail banks. And credit unions generally charge less. They have better terms. They are generally pretty well managed. The same thing's true with community banks. If you look at the community banks around the country, they consistently are profitable, and they fund loans in the local community. So we'd be a lot better off if people would move their business to credit unions and community banks. And, of course, the big banks immediately go to Congress and go, oh, this is not fair. These people, they're being unfair to us. We need rules to limit what they can do.
David K. Johnston, a reporter for the New York Times for 13 years, is the author of Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, both New York Times bestsellers. He's also the president of Investigative Reporters and Editors and the recipient of a Pulitzer Prize. In the fine print, he reveals just how major corporations work with the government to relax rules, rewrite regulations, and enforce only the rules that benefit them. Well, David, you know, we've only scratched the surface. Your book goes into much detail on many subjects. I wanted to get into the utilities. Maybe we'll have a chance on Tuesday night. David K. Johnston, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bunny.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase.
Hakuna Matata. Ain't no peasant craze.
It means no worries for the rest of your days. It's our problem-free philosophy.
Hakuna Matata.
Why, when he was a young warthog.
When I was a young warthog.
Very nice.
Thanks.
He found his aroma lacked a certain appeal. He could clear the savannah after every meal.
I'm a sensitive soul, though I seem thick-skinned. And it hurt that my friends never stood downwind. And oh, the shame.
He was a change.
What a change in my name.
Oh, what's in a name?
Downhearted.
How did you feel?
Every time that I...
Hey, Pumba, not in front of the kids.
Oh, sorry.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata. Ain't no passing phrase.
It means no worries for the rest of your days.
Yes, sing it, kid.
It's our problem-free philosophy.
Hakuna Matata.
Days.
It's our problem-free philosophy.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata.
Hakuna Matata. Hakuna Matata.
Coming up next, the best climate projections are extreme.
From the Jennifer and Ted Stanley Studios in Boston, this is Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwin. The scientific consensus holds that climate change is upon us, but there are many different projections as to how fast it's happening and how hot it might get. Now, a new study has found that the most alarming global warming estimates may in fact be the most accurate. Joining us is one of the report's lead authors, John Fasulo, a climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the various projections that have been made about the extent of global warming?
Well, we have a range of about 3 degrees Fahrenheit to 8 degrees. To make that understandable, the basic question we're trying to answer is whether or not New York City becomes more like Richmond, Virginia in the future, or whether it becomes more like Atlanta, Georgia.
Now, when you say 3 to 8 degrees, we're talking Fahrenheit, we're talking Celsius.
We're talking Fahrenheit, and we're talking by 2100. So, of course, there's the capacity for further warming after that, or if we take action to curb climate change, less warming eventually.
So why is there such a large range between these estimates?
Well, it all relates to how clouds change in the models. The largest source of uncertainty is how clouds will change in a warming environment. Some models show that clouds will increase in extent in a warmer climate and reflect more sunlight back to space, while other models show clouds will actually decrease in extent and let more sunlight into the system.
So how did you take cloud cover into account for your analysis?
Evaluating clouds in models is difficult. The challenge, because our observations of clouds are not too good, and then comparing those observations to models isn't straightforward. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. So we tried to skirt this whole issue by looking at the environment in which clouds occur rather than clouds themselves, things like relative humidity in the environment. And over the past 10 years, we've had NASA satellites that have observed relative humidity on a global scale throughout the atmosphere. And so we've been able to take those observations and ask the question, which models actually reproduce the relative humidity variations that we see more accurately?
Which of the projections ended up being the most accurate?
Well, it turns out that there's a set of models that is generally on the low end of the spectrum for projecting the future that does a very poor job in resolving these basic interactions that we see in the observations. There are these areas of the tropics called the dry zones, and we think of tropics as being very moist. But in fact, once you get away from the surface in the tropics, most of the tropics is actually very dry. As these dry zones expand over time, you can think of it as an iris of the climate system, that iris opens up and the amount of clouds decreases, therefore letting more sunlight into the system and adding to additional warming. There is a set of models that's generally doing this very well, and those tend to be on the higher range of the spectrum for future projections.
Which models are those?
One is from the UK Met Office, one is from NCAR, where I work in Boulder, Colorado, and then one is from Japan.
Now, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is made up literally of thousands of scientists from around the world, the models that they have accepted have consistently underestimated the extent of warming. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, I think that body tends to be fairly apolitical and is hesitant to make a judgment as to which models are more reliable unless there's some very sound scientific basis for doing so. So they tend to weight all the models evenly, even though within the science community we know that some of the models are better than others. And so this is an attempt to provide an objective measure as to which models are doing the best. And therefore, maybe we should screen out a few of the models before we make a projection of what the future holds.
What are the prospects of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change taking your research and applying it to their next series of reports, which come next year?
Well, they have included my analysis in their next report, and so it'll be up to the authors as to how they incorporate that information. It's a very difficult problem. It's been around for 30 years, and they're going to be hesitant to make any bold proclamations based on a single study, and I think they should be. I think that science generally works by consensus and an evolving understanding of the issues, and so this will be one piece of evidence that they consider, but really there needs to be a broader effort across the scientific community to improve models and create a more complete picture as to what the possible future may hold.
Based on your study, how hot do you think the world is going to get?
We feel that the upper half of the range of 5 degrees Fahrenheit to 8 degrees Fahrenheit is probably most likely by 2100. But a lot of that warming is really up to us as well. How much are we going to emit into the atmosphere, and how strongly are we going to force the climate system? And that is something that we can control, and we really should make it a focus.
What would the world be like 5 degrees hotter?
Some of the scenarios that we look at in these models are really quite alarming. It's a whole different world. The character of snow, of sea ice, the Arctic changes considerably. And that doesn't even touch on the question of adaptation and whether various parts of the environment that we live in are going to be able to adapt to such a sudden and really large shift in temperature zones.
What do you hope comes out of this research?
Well, we have two main messages, and one is, from a policy standpoint, we really need to consider the best science in forging the best policy for dealing with global warming. And it's certainly upon us, and is going to continue to get worse. Putting our heads in the sand doesn't help us prepare for the future that we're living into. The other message that from our study is to modeling communities and to give a message as to how best to improve models so that we can better serve the needs of society.
What's it like to work on climate research in a nation where there's been so much well-funded skepticism against this concept?
It's a challenge, and I think most of the scientists who work in the field have a sense that eventually the truth will win out. But what is frustrating is that we are in some ways racing against the clock. If we keep emitting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and then wait to deal with it, we're going to look at greater impacts overall from sea level rise and weather extremes. And so the more we delay action, the more expense we have to deal with instead of dealing with it inexpensively upfront and as soon as possible.
John Fasulo is a climate scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you, Steve.
were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
What is happening to me?
The answer is up there, Neo. It's the question that drives us.
What is the Matrix?
The Matrix is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
They're watching you, Neo.
Human beings are a disease. You are a cancer of this planet. And we are the cure.
Get me the hell out of here!
Welcome to the real world.
So you're here to save the world.
So what do you need? Guns. Lots of guns.
No one has ever done anything like this.
That's why it's going to work.
Buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy. Because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Now for something completely different.